Welcome to the It Could Be Said podcast. My name is Will Cawley, and I'm joined as always by the one, the only Luke Middup. How are you, Luke?
I'm good, thanks. You forgot my title.
Oh, I am so sorry. Dr. Luke Middup. Dr. Luke Middup.
Thank you.
Did you do anything special for St. George's Day?
No, I didn't. Did you, Will?
No, I didn't. Good job Labour's giving us a bank holiday for it, then.
Yeah, because, you know, every other year I do precisely nothing, so, you know.
Anyway, today we're going to talk about opinion polls. Polls. We've had a deluge of opinion polls about the forthcoming UK general election, and they tell a quite interesting story. And the story is Labour's doomed.
They're all doomed.
It'd be worth saying, just briefly before we get into them, is you may, if you are the type of cool cat that listens to 538's politics podcast, you've heard Nate Silver talk about and also write about how this is more of a risk than it may seem when you look at the polls, because UK polls get it wrong all the time. Now, I'd say two things to this. First of all, Nate Silver's probably been a bit unfair to the British polling industry. It's always harder to poll a parliamentary election than a presidential election, because the relationship between how people vote, the popular vote, and what you actually end up getting in Parliament is less precise. So the type of oddity you got in this, say, this American election, where Trump had less votes than Hillary but managed to win the electoral college, those sorts of things are more frequent in parliamentary elections. Everybody knew the Tories were going to be the winner of the 2015 election. That wasn't a surprise. The surprise was they managed to win in a way to give them a majority, which everybody assumed that wouldn't be possible. So that's and this is true in America. American congressional polling is uniformly awful. Polls of how the House is going to go, how the Senate's going to go, it never gets the national swing right, because it's a much more complicated thing to do. The second thing, even if you accept the fact that polls get it wrong in Britain more than most, and Rob Ford, if you're listening, which you won't be, but if you were listening, I'm not saying that's true, I'm just saying even if you accept that, the error isn't symmetrical. We know for a fact that opinion polls since the 70s have, actually since 1970 even, always overestimate in favour of Labour, that Tories almost always do better than the final poll predicts. And that's true in elections where the Tories won, such as 83 and 87, but it's also true of elections such as 97. I mean, 97, although the Tories did very badly in 97, it wasn't as bad as some polls predicted at the time. So to say, there are all sorts of reasons why this may be a gamble for Theresa May. I don't think analysis of past polls is one of them.
Well, I agree with it. I agree with everything you've just said. So
moving on.
Moving on.
To something that, after defending the polling industry and defending reporting on British polls, we do have to kind of, I suppose at 5:30 we call this bad use of polling, which was the Mail on Sunday that has perhaps the most scandalous use of an opinion poll to justify a headline they wanted to write, I have seen in quite some time, didn't they, Luke?
Yeah, if they don't get taken before the Press Complaints Commission for this, I will eat my hat a la Paddy Ashdown. It was an appalling use of statistics. Do you just want to talk our listeners through exactly what the Mail did, Will?
Yeah, and by the way, he owns several hats, so that's no empty threat. What the Mail on Sunday did, a big headline saying that the support for the Tories had been cut in half due to the signs that they may embrace limited tax rises, cuts in pensioners' benefits, stuff like that. Basically, the Mail saying you're suggesting and do policies we don't like, and it's cost you support. But what they did to get these results was take their last poll that had been done by ICM and compare it with a new poll that had been done by Servation. Now, in anything with opinion polls, you really aren't meant to compare polls done by different companies, because every company has its own methodology. I got that wrong. and they all have their own house effects, which we'll come on to in a minute. And so if you compare ICM with Servation, you're not really comparing like with like. What made it even worse was, if you took the Servation poll and compared it to Servation's last poll, it didn't show support for the Tories halving. It showed that support for the Tories had slightly increased. So it was a complete nonsense all round.
Worse than that, Servation have a pattern of overestimating UKIP support, overestimating Labour support, and underestimating Conservative support. This is a pattern they've had in their polling for as long as I can remember. Certainly the UKIP effect. So I always tend to slightly discount Servation polling. They're not, without being insulting to them, they are not the gold standard of UK polling by any stretch of the imagination.
No, and they're a relatively young company. I mean, I think I first remember hearing about them in the 2010 election. No earlier than 2010. May have been as late as 2015. And they've always had this house effect in favour of Labour and UKIP, which does suggest that one of the issues they may have is too many low-income voters in their sample. Moving away from the Mail on Sunday, let's talk through the other, and it has to be said actually, before we get move on, what's incredible is this poll, which was the worst poll for the Tories all week, still had them on 40%, still had them leading Labour by 11 points, still had them on course to get a larger majority than they already have. Just rather than a three-figure majority, it might be a majority of 50. So it gives you an idea of just how bad the rest of the polls were for the Labour Party.
I don't think bad covers it. To paraphrase the late, great Anthony King, these polls wouldn't indicate a landslide, they would indicate an asteroid hitting the planet Labour and wiping out most life.
What the polls basically show is four things. In terms of UK polls, we'll get on to Wales and Scotland in a minute. So the first thing, and I think this is probably the most crucial thing, is they show UKIP just imploding. So for those who don't know, UKIP, United Kingdom Independence Party, yes, that weird guy keeps following Donald Trump around trying to get his photo. This is Nigel Farage's party, and he has gone to spend time in Europe, because he'd rather spend time in Europe, which is a bit odd for a far-right populist leader to want to do, but hey-ho.
Yeah, embracing Donald Trump and Hungarian quasi-fascists, but yeah.
That's more normal for them to do, but wanting to hang out in Strasbourg all the time seems a bit odd. Maybe he's gone native. But they, at the last election, they had an astonishing performance. They got 13% of the vote, many, many times more than the radical right had gotten in previous elections, even when you count for the fact that the neo-Nazi BNP had imploded. But now, I mean, you look at these polls, I mean, the highest anyone has them on now is 8%. YouGov and panel base have them as low as 5%. The Ipsos Mori poll that came out today has them on 4%. So they, I mean, 4 or 5% would be the lowest the far right has gotten in this country, at least since 2005, maybe 2001, because even in 2005 you had Veritas, you had UKIP, and you had the BNP. So this is historic lows for this type of populist right parties.
Can I just come in there, Will? I think you've got to be careful about labelling UKIP a far-right party. They are certainly further to the right than the other three main UK-wide parties, but I wouldn't lump them together with Geert Wilders in the Netherlands or Marine Le Pen in France.
Why not?
Well, I think two reasons. First, First, you've got to remember that UKIP in the past have actually been quite active in throwing out members with anti-Semitic or racist views. They were very strong against entryism from the BNP, for example. Also, you look at elements of their policy outline. They're admittedly, some of it's vague, but I would say they're more populist than left or right. Some of the stuff they advocate for is actually quite big state, quite interventionist.
Yeah, but that's true of the BNP. That's not true. That's not relevant, because that's true of the BNP. It's true of the National Front in France. I mean, in terms of whether you could call them for, I mean, they are clearly not as bad as the BNP, the British National Party. The British National Party was a neo-Nazi party that had links to various street gangs. You know, you could cite evidence where if the BNP became councillors, there'd be an uptick in hate crime and stuff like this. So they're not as bad as the BNP, but the FAR is a broad category, and it does have differences. You look at the things driving UKIP, you look at the basis of their support, it clearly has commonality with the likes of National Front, or Alternative for Germany, or Geert Wilders. You know, you look at what they've been talking about all week about the burqa ban and stuff like this. You know, I don't think it's credible to say this isn't the area of politics they work within. Doesn't mean everybody who's in UKIP is a racist. It doesn't even mean that UKIP's policies are entirely racist. But I think to say they're not far right is strange, because you have the centre-right, which is the Tories. UKIP are to the right of them. Well, that makes them far right. I mean, that's literally what the phrase far right means.
Yeah, but I wouldn't call them
Go on.
In a literal sense, you're right, but in a figurative sense, you know as well as I do that the phrase far right has certain connotations around how you treat people of different ethnicity, different background, different sexual orientation, etc. UKIP's had its issues.
One quick thing on that. You keep trying to impose a very rigid definition of far right, and I just think the world has moved on. Now, you look at, say, the National Front. I mean, look, National Front kicks people out if they go too far, in inverted commas. You know, Le Pen had to kick out her own father to keep banging on about the Holocaust. Things like gay rights. UKIP has been quite strong against gay rights on many issues. Certainly many of the individual members were deeply unhappy about gay marriage being legalised. But equally, look at Holland with Pim Fortuyn. That was a far-right party that was quite pro-gay rights. Something that Marine Le Pen's also picked up to a certain extent because of the possibilities of using it as a wedge issue against Muslims. Again, I mean, I think let's not get too bogged down in this. I mean, I would never say UKIP are like the BNP. But what I think is true is that the implosion of the BNP helped UKIP. A lot of people who had voted BNP in 2005, 2010 came to UKIP when BNP disappeared, and that further inflated their support. So if we're getting to a point now that UKIP can only get 4-5%, this really is that to the right of Tory vote being squeezed to its very, very, very base in quite exceptional ways.
Okay.
Do you want to talk about the interesting week Paul Nuttall had?
Yeah, UKIP has come out with a policy to ban the burqa. Unfortunately, it was a bit ill-drawn, so they had to rush out a clarification that this would not apply to people wearing big hats or beekeepers.
Still no word on whether it applies to women getting married who want a full veil.
Yeah, this is the level of silliness to which this election has already sunken. Well,
yes. I mean, I think the problem that UKIP has, and the thing is, it's remarkable things have gone this bad for UKIP before they lose their members of the European Parliament when we actually leave the European Union in 2 years' time, because then they'll lose so much funding and so much infrastructure that it'll be very bad for them. But the things that UKIP are is that basically it was to a certain extent held together by Nigel Farage's sheer force of personality. Whatever you say about the man, he is very charismatic, he is very good at TV. He has a clear pitch to voters. And whenever he goes away, the party loses all shape and discipline. And Paul Nuttall clearly is struggling to impose himself. And as we'll talk through, the nature of this election with Theresa May having a tough on immigration, a pro-Brexit, economically moderate pitch is not, it is designed to appeal to people who switched from Labour to UKIP in the course of the last parliaments. Talking of Labour,
Run for the hills!
So, Labour...
No, they're coming from the hills! Run away from the hills! Run away from the hills!
So, Labour... The highest score Labour has in the polls I've got ahead of me. So, I've got ones from Panelbase, Ipsos Mori, ICM, ComMet, and YouGov. The highest figure is 27%. To bear that in mind, they got just under 31% at the last general election. Their worst ever performance at a general election in recent time was in 1983, when they got 28%, although they had polled higher in the run-up to the election. So this is pretty catastrophic for Labour.
And just to bear in mind with that... 83 comparison, they were under a very, very strong third party challenge at that point from the SDP Liberal Alliance, what later became the Liberal Democrats. That really isn't there this time.
Well, no, I mean, let's talk about Labour and Lib Dems together then. So Lib Dems kind of are flatlined. I mean, that's kind of true of Labour as well. The damage has been done to Labour in the past, but the Lib Dems are basically bobbing around at between 10 and 13%, closer to 10 and 10 and 11 in most of these polls. It is an improvement from last time, and it's up about, they got about 8% in the general election, but still way, way, way behind, not just what they got in elections like 2010, 2005, and they got a quarter of the vote, but way behind what they got in elections such as 92
and 87.
So this is, by historic standards, you can talk about Liberal revival from a low base. This is still pretty low for the Liberal Democrats.
I have no evidence to back this up apart from intuition, but I think the polls may be slightly underestimating Lib Dem support. Because you've got to remember how this is done. One of the things pollsters do is ask people how they voted in the last election and wait their polls from that. So I suspect actually, come June the 8th, you may well see the Lib Dems up at 14, 15, 16% of the vote.
I'm sceptical. Because...
No, but you do follow my reasoning.
I follow your reasoning, yes. I follow your reasoning in the sense of they had such... Basically, pollsters aren't always convinced if someone says they... So there's two things there. So one is, if you say you don't know, British pollsters will allocate you based on previous votes. So the idea being, if you say you don't know now, you'll probably revert to your previous party.
And there's a lot of academic evidence that would support that as an assumption.
And because the Lib Dems had so few voters last time, they will get less of a bump from that. Also, yes, I think that's probably the main reason. I mean, my feeling is I think the Lib Dems will do well to get up to 16%, because they always did poorly in European elections because they were an unabashedly pro-European party with quite a Eurosceptical voter base in certain key areas. And I think that is this party of Remain. It's a good way of rebuilding strength in big cities and university towns. It's going to do a number on them in the southwest, which used to be their heartland. I also think, David Law's always had this interesting theory, that the Lib Dems do best when Labour's strong, because once it became clear the Lib Dems are always going to work with Labour over the Tories, until 2010 obviously, people wouldn't risk voting for the Lib Dems if they didn't think the Labour Prime Minister that you'd get by not voting Tory was credible and not a threat to their own personal finances, and that's just not going to be a case this time around.
Yeah. David Laws, by the way, used to be a fairly senior Lib Dem MP.
Yes, and he lost his seat in a gigantic cataclysmic swing where he lost, what, a seat of like 20, a seat with a 20,000 majority?
Something close to that, yeah.
The safest.
And by the way, it was expected that he would re-stand in that seat of Yeovil. He isn't going to do that, which I think gives you some sort of hint at what somebody who ought to know his stuff thinks about what's going to happen to the Lib Dems in the South West.
Yeah, I don't think the Lib Dems are going to do anything in the South West. It's whether they can pick up some places in university towns where you have a younger, educated population that's annoyed at Brexit. Now, what's happening is that what we've basically got is you've got UKIP's implosion, you've got Labour's decline from an already low level, and you've got the Lib Dems not really picking up much support. So all these voters that are leaving UKIP, leaving Labour, they have to go somewhere, and it's not the Green Party, Luke. It's not the Green Party.
No.
So I'm actually going to read these out. So these are the polls I have. You have Panel Base with them on 49%. You have Ipsos Mori with them on 49% as well, which is a 5%.
This is a Conservative, by the way, just to be clear.
49% with that's a 5% increase on the last Ipsos Mori poll. ICM had them on 48%. Comres had them on 50%. YouGov had them on 48%. This is on. I mean, Cameron briefly got this in 2008, 2009 at the height of the financial crisis before they re-embraced austerity economics. And Thatcher hit this at times in the 80s, but these are figures Tories don't very often get because of the structural bias in the polling industry against them. Luke is...
Well, I mean, it's astonishing. And I mean, if you map some of those onto calculations of seats, you're getting a Tory majority of anywhere between 160 and 200 seats at the outside.
Well, it was basically...
I mean, it would be an absolutely crushing defeat for Labour.
What's basically happening is Labour has gotten away with some really awful performances that haven't got the punishment they would have gotten if the shoe was on the other foot. So John Major and William Hague both got 165 seats, give or take, way below anything Labour's got in the post-war era. But both of them got a larger share of the vote than Ed Miliband got in 2015 when he got 230 seats. Gordon Brown got 2 percentage points less of the popular vote than John Major, even though he got 90 more seats. Because Labour's vote is quite well distributed, because it's concentrated in a lot of smaller seats where people don't tend to come out as voting as high numbers, they can actually get a lot of seats on a relatively small share of the vote. I think what this massive shift of Labour to UKIP voters to the Tories is going to break that, and it's actually going to be the Tories are going to sweep the board in a lot of these smaller, low turnout seats, and it really could be a majority bigger than what Tony Blair got, because it's like we said in 83, not only was the progressive vote split, so it meant that the Tories didn't pick up voters annoyed with Labour, but the Tories lost votes to the SDP Liberal Alliance. We've never had a situation in recent memory where the Labour vote is declining and the Tory vote is surging in this way.
No. And I mean, I think we've got to put this in context. These polls come after a relatively good week for Jeremy Corbyn. He launched his campaign relatively strongly. There's been a lot of policy out from Labour. Labour MPs who have, you know, in the past been very vocally dissatisfied with Jeremy Corbyn have fallen in behind the leader because they don't want to be seen as rocking the boat in an election campaign. And still, he gets these terrible poll ratings.
It's not just the past week. I mean, he's had a good Easter, because whilst May was busy preparing to call the election, she completely disappeared from everyone's TV screens. And so Labour had the run of it, and they actually introduced a lot of, I don't actually think they're very good policies, but they introduced a lot of, they introduced a lot of policies.
They filled in a policy vacuum, let's put it that way.
Both of us remember when Ken Clark came to talk at university, when we were both there at Nottingham University, and he mocked Michael Howard's 2005 manifesto, written by David Cameron, as promising, cleaner policemen and more hospitals. You know, this is small bore stuff. It's like, it's the type of thing that unpopular oppositions do because they can't sell a vision to the country. So like at the beginning, we mocked the idea of having four bank holidays. It's just like,
It's if you were in front of an audience of cannibals, Jeremy Corbyn has gotten to the stage of promising them missionaries.
But in many ways, as dramatic as these figures are, they are actually more dramatic if you get away from the UK picture as a whole. So let's deal with Scotland first, because these broke. These broke before the Welsh poll. So, I'm sure as everybody knows, Scotland had a referendum in 2014 about whether to separate from the United Kingdom. That was defeated by 55 to 45%. The SNP tried to claim that in Scottish referendums, it's the minority who wins, and has worked on that assumption ever since. What then happened in the following election, unfortunately for the pro-union side, there are three unionist parties, there's really only one independence party, and so the SNP took 56 of Scotland's 59 MPs. It's not looking like that's going to be repeated this time though.
No, the one thing I will say about this, and it's just a caveat, there are a lot fewer Scottish opinion polls than there are UK-wide, and the gap between them is longer. So, the margin of error for rogue polls is greater in Scotland and Wales than it is in the UK as a whole. That said, the two polls were very similar in the results they produced.
So what both polls basically show is that the SNP has lost ground since its high point, which we don't just need to go off the basis of polls. We know that they lost their majority in the Scottish Parliament in 2016. The Tories have gained quite dramatically at the expense of Labour, Lib Dems, and probably to a certain extent SNP, because you used to have tartan Tories that voted for Alex Salmond as the centre-right alternative to Labour. So, to give you, say, let's go with panel base, the figures are quite similar. They had SNP on 44%, which is down 6, Conservatives on 33%, up 18. Labour on 13, down 11. Lib Dems on 5, down 3. So what you're seeing is that the unionist forces are starting to coalesce around the Conservatives. This is a tactic that worked for the Tories at the last Scottish Parliament elections, where they were, whereas Labour's kind of having a nervous breakdown about what it thought of the union and whether it was a party for maintaining the link with England, or whether it was going to become a agnostic party. The Tories kind of went, no, we are for the union. If you want to say, you want to send a message to the SNP, you need to vote for us. That worked. They became the second largest party in Scottish Parliament. This time round, they're going with the idea of, we said no, we meant no. If you want to stop Nicola Sturgeon calling a second independence referendum, you have to vote Tory.
Yeah, just to explain the reasoning behind that, Scotland voted very heavily for Remain in the Brexit referendum. So Nicola Sturgeon has claimed that because Brexit is happening, and it's happening allegedly against the will of the Scottish people, that gives her a mandate, many people would say an excuse, to ask to hold a second independence referendum. And she made that call a couple of months ago, and I'm somebody that lives in Scotland, and it has basically become the issue in Scottish politics again. The problem the Labour Party has got is that it wants to talk about anything but independence, because not only has its popularity declined radically in the last, really in the last 7 to 8 years, but its remaining voters are split pretty much down the middle on the issue of independence. So you've had Kezia Dugdale, the Scottish Labour leader, wanting to talk about benefits, the health service, anything but independence. Whereas Nicola Sturgeon and Ruth Davidson can be very clear, because their voters, on the whole, are very clear. Nicola Sturgeon's a pro-independence. Ruth Davidson's, the Conservatives, are very anti-independence, whereas Labour's remaining voters are split down the middle.
Is it the Union voters, or is it the voters they hope to get back? Because my impression is that Labour's actual voters are pretty, they're not like obsessed about it, but they're pretty pro-Union. It's the fact that for Labour to get back to any semblance of its former position in Scotland, or to retain things like its Glasgow Council seat for election next week, they need to keep independence voters, or sorry, need to regain independence voters.
Well, that's the perception. But even among the supporters they've already got, I would say you're probably right. But I would say a lot of them are you're probably right in the sense that a lot of them are agnostic. They care about other issues more than they care about independence. But the fact is, if you ask the question, they break pretty much 50-50.
There's an interesting thing as well that's happened in Scotland, which is the impact of the referendum to leave the European Union, because it's easy to forget that 38% of Scotland did vote to leave the European Union, which is low by British standards. It's lower than even in Northern Ireland. But 30, I mean, I don't, maybe France, but I don't think there's many other countries where you get 38% to leave the European Union. I mean, that's a high figure.
And it's interesting. The seats the Tories have the best chance of winning, so places like Berwick, Roxburgh and Selkirk, Dumfries and Galloway, Aberdeen West and Kincardine, Perth and North Perthshire, or even Angus Robertson's seat in Moray. Those are the seats where actually it was, the Brexit vote was much higher than 38%. In Moray, it was actually 51-49.
Okay. So what's happening is actually you are getting this shift where unionist votes coalesce around Conservatives, but also Leave voters are coalescing around Conservatives as well. And that actually probably one of the reasons you've had a drift away from the SNP as well, is that a lot of SNP voters who voted Leave, because, you know, they're nationalists, they believe in national sovereignty, the same way they don't want the English telling them what to do, they don't want Brussels to do it either, they're not happy with Nicola Sturgeon going so heavy on the idea, we will, you know, we'll throw off the shackles of London to put the shackles of Brussels back on us.
I mean, also, the seats the Tories are competitive in, with one or two exceptions, are rural and coastal, which means that farming and fishing are big industries. And, you know, the CAP and particularly the Common Fisheries Policy is powerfully unpopular up here.
Well, I mean, people forget, but in the 70s, Scotland was probably the hotbed of British Euroscepticism. I mean, the SNP were actually an anti-European party. And it is hilarious to see the SNP's position on whether they'll actually stay in the EU if they were to become independent is not clear. And you talk about how it's the only thing that anybody wants to talk about, whether there's going to be a second independence referendum. Nicola Sturgeon has gone awfully bashful about it the past week. Even though the Nationalist paper, called The Nationalist, said it was now...
The National, said
it was a chance to get a second referendum. The SNP's official line that it isn't about getting a second independence referendum. And she has actually postponed her planned statement that was due for, was it yesterday?
Yeah.
About the mechanism she was going to, the measures she was going to take to force the British government to let her call a new referendum.
There is one issue I'd just like to go back on. You said Scotland voted 38% for Brexit. That's right. But you've got to bear in mind that figure is really quite impressive when you consider that there was virtually no Leave campaign north of the border. I mean, the most prominent politician they could find is a guy called Tom Harris, who isn't even a sitting MP. He's now a columnist for the Daily Telegraph.
Didn't Sellers campaign? Oh, no, Sellers got...
No, Jim Sellers, yeah. Who was the former deputy leader of the SNP, made some noises about campaigning for Brexit, and then Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon told him to go and sit in a corner.
I mean, I absolutely agree. If you're talking about really impressive Brexit results, I mean, the one that's most impressive is Wales, which somehow, despite literally nobody, not even a blogger for The Telegraph, campaigning for Brexit, did actually vote for Brexit.
Yeah, is that a cue to move on to the Welsh polls, Will?
It is a cue to, unless you had anything else to say about the Scottish polls.
No, except to say I think in future episodes I want to come back and look at the seats that might be competitive.
Yes, no, I think, well, yes, I think that, so basically, actually, here's what I'm saying. So as we mentioned, it was 56-59 last time round. On the basis of these figures, you might expect Tories to rise up to 12. That'd be their best performance in Scotland since 92. There's also
Can I just correct you there, Will?
Mm-hmm.
You've got to remember that because of devolution, Scottish number of MPs went down from 70 to 59. So actually 92 isn't the right comparison. 83 would be the right comparison proportionally.
To correct you, it wasn't 70, it was 72.
No, you said 92.
No. I said 70. It was 72.
Oh, I apologise then. I thought you said 92.
No. Scotland used to have 72 seats.
Ah, okay. 72. Well, yeah. My point still stands. The election to compare that to would still be 83 then.
Yeah, okay. And there's a chance the Lib Dems might pick up a couple as well.
As I say, in future weeks, I want to go and look at that seat by seat.
Going to Wales. So Wales, as we mentioned, did vote for Brexit. It has also always voted slavishly, I don't think it's an exaggeration, for the Labour Party. To give you an idea of Labour's hegemony in Wales, the last person to defeat the Labour Party in Wales was David Lloyd George in 1918, and he was Welsh and had just won the First World War. Ever since then, Labour has been the leading party in Wales. Even in 1931, when the national government destroyed Labour to the point it was reduced to 59 seats in the entire UK, it's still got the most seats in Wales. Since 1935, it's got an absolute majority of the seats in Wales at every election. But the poll that was heavily trailed by the academic Roger Scully, who was beside himself in excitement, shows an earthquake. The figures, and this is done by YouGov ITV, was Conservatives on 40%, an increase of 12 from the last time these polls were done. Labour on 30%, a decrease of 3. Lib Dems on 8%, basically flatlining. Plaid Cymru, which is the Welsh nationalists, although they're not as popular as Scottish nationalists because they are limited really as the party of Welsh speakers in Northern Wales. They struggle to get out of their heartlands. They're on 13%. UKIP on 6%, down 7%.
I mean, just to give you an anecdote, I share an office at work, and Roger Scully tweeted these poll results just before I left the office. My office mate looked at me very strangely because I swore quite loudly when that tweet came through.
These are an earthquake. I mean, it is like Utah going to the Democrats in a presidential election.
No, I think Alabama.
No, because Alabama used to be Democrat. So Utah was always Republican. I mean, I can't remember the last time it's gone.
64, I think.
Did it go to Johnson?
Yeah, I think.
Oh, okay. I'll take it back then. But, I mean, it is absolutely staggering, the idea that Labour could lose Wales.
I mean, let's just sort of step back from this to get our arms around the scale of this. Labour would not have a single seat in Wales outside of the valleys, the former coal mining areas. Labour would lose seats that in the past have been held by Labour prime ministers. This would be devastating.
The if you take these figures, it gives the Tories 21 of the Welsh seats. Their best return is 14. The last time the Tories managed to win in Wales was before universal suffrage. You have to go back to the 1850s when most of the Welsh seats were actually uncontested. Scotland, there have been times in the 20th century when Scotland was happy hunting ground for the Tories, famously in 1955. Wales has never been good hunting ground for the Tories because it's the Tory party really is based fundamentally, historically, on the Church of England. And an odd belief that British kings should be Catholic if they want to be, and Wales as a non-conformist, non-Anglican, Protestant country, never good hunting ground for the Tories. So this would be a genuinely historic result.
I mean, the one thing to say is, I think Labour in Wales is going to have, to a large extent, the same problem that Labour in Scotland had in 2015, which you've now got a bunch of MPs who have had no experience running against a strong Conservative opposition. In the case of Scotland, it was a strong SNP opposition. Looking around thinking, how the heck do we campaign? We've kind of forgotten how to do it. We just show up every 5 years and stick on a red rosette.
Well, again, because, I don't know what situation in Wales, but in Scotland, it's like, they just hadn't been doing their canvassing returns. They didn't know where their voters were. The party machine had no activists. The whole thing was moribund. And I'm sure the same is true in a lot of these Welsh seats. The key thing, again, like in England, is that collapse of the UKIP vote. So Labour has been forewarned. Labour's vote has been declining with the rise of UKIP, particularly in South Wales, with unhappiness over immigration, over deindustrialisation, unhappiness with the European Union. And what's happening is that as UKIP has imploded, those voters have said, well, we've already made a psychological break with the Labour Party, let's go and vote for the Tories, we actually agree with them. Is UKIP as a gateway drug to vote in Tory?
I mean, I also, you've got to remember as well, when Labour has struggled previously, it's had leaders who held a Welsh seat or a leader who was Welsh. I don't think Jeremy Corbyn, you know, would play particularly well to an audience in somewhere like the Rhondda.
No, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn's a very English sort of radical that I don't think the Scots or the Welsh have much experience or liking of. He's a very English unpopular populist.
Okay, so just to round this discussion off, Will, if we see another set of polls like this next week, at what point does the Labour Party experience what the Conservative Party did in 97, where a national campaign kind of falls apart and it becomes everybody for themselves trying to hold their own seats?
It's really difficult to know, because the Labour moderates are terrified that they'll get blamed and they won't be able to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. By tradition, Labour campaigns are more centrally organised because they rely on the big unions more, and they rely on materials developed by central office more as well. So the other thing as well is it's difficult for Labour MPs to know which way to turn, because, you know, do they need tighten up their offer on immigration? Do they need to tighten up their offer on opposing Brexit? Reality is the issue is the same issue as what faced the Tories in 97, which is they're hopelessly divided, and the people don't like divided parties because divided parties can't provide effective government. And the people have looked at the two leaders and have decided we would rather have this guy, or this woman in this case, as leader, rather than your guy. I mean, there's no way around to let somebody campaigning to hold on to a Labour seat. The fact that Jeremy Corbyn is historically unpopular. Now, I've got the stats up here, actually. So, Theresa May's popularity, she has a plus 10 popularity, according to YouGov. So that means, of the population, 38% don't think very highly of her, 48% do. Jeremy Corbyn's popularity is minus 42. 64% have an unfavourable opinion of him, only 22% do. That is staggering. And the problem for the progressive, we often talk about progressive alliances and stuff like that, all progressives have unfavourable opinions. So Tim Farron's is minus 26, the leader of the Liberal Democrats. Nicola Sturgeon's is minus 36, although obviously it'll be higher in Scotland. This is staggering. If you look at Ipsos Mori, their poll had the British people think 61% to 23% that Theresa May would make a better Prime Minister than Corbyn. That's higher than anybody else has had that, and have been asking this question since 1979. Corbyn is historically unpopular, but as well, Theresa May is actually very popular as well. That, you know, she, you know, this is the first time we've had since Eden where Prime Ministers actually go into the country in their honeymoon. You know, she's been Prime Minister for less than a year. She, although she hasn't really achieved much, she's kind of shown herself to be a firm hand at the tiller, going through the preparations for Brexit in the way that people seem to be responding to. Everything through these polls, through the leaders' personal ratings, suggests this is just going to be a thumping victory for the Tories on a scale we may not have seen since before the Second World War.
I mean, just to talk about my analogy, just so that people understand what I'm talking about, John Major, the Tory Prime Minister in 97, had a hellish experience with issuing a Conservative manifesto, a Conservative platform, and then having individual MPs in seat after seat after seat dissent from that manifesto, issue their own manifestos, their own personal platforms, which were generally much more Eurosceptic. And you've got to remember, Jeremy Corbyn, more than 70% of his MPs don't want him to be leader of the Labour Party. I take the points you're making about Labour being much more dependent on the unions, but I still think there is a risk that you will get Labour MPs using their election addresses, their own prospectus, if you like, to put out their own manifestos, to put out their own platforms. I think that's going to be particular. I think it's going to be a particular problem in seats that were either very heavily Brexit or very heavily Remain, because Corbyn has tried to straddle this issue in a way that is really unconvincing. And one of the problems Labour's got is that the seat that it is defending, some of the most Remain-leaning seats and some of the most Brexit-leaning seats at the same time.
But a problem Labour has, it's not that I discount it, I just don't think individual Labour MPs are going to know which way to turn, because the reason why you had a lot of those election addresses in 97 was that you had the referendum party causing havoc in Tory constituencies and trying to take away right-wing Eurosceptic voters, and these MPs knew which way they wanted to go on the question of the Euro and European Union membership. The issue Labour has is, I think you might get some people in very Remain places given those addresses, but on a broader level, the reason why Labour's Brexit policy is a muddle is because it's a muddle, because they have a big chunk of their voters who want to end freedom of movement, but they have another big chunk of their voters who want to stay in the European Union, and they cannot, for the life of them, resolve this issue without saying goodbye to half their voters.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness to Jeremy Corbyn, this would be a problem for a politician of much greater subtlety and political nous than he is.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, what I think a lot of people are working on the assumption of, if Corbyn loses badly, there'll be a leadership election, they'll get rid of Corbyn, and then Labour become more effective. But I think the next Labour leadership election is the party's going to tear itself apart over Brexit, over immigration. Because every serious Labour politician knows the figures about how many constituencies in England and Wales voted Leave. They know they can't win again unless they bring in some controls on immigration. And that means that they need to support a somewhat hard Brexit. But not only would the activists not want Brexit, they don't want the controls on immigration either. So someone like Yvette Cooper, who you could see doing quite a good firefight in Red Adair, getting, make the party more professional, getting at least doing the bare minimum to be an effective opposition. It's difficult to see how she could win amongst the members when pushing a pro-immigration controls message.
Yeah, I mean, Labour really is up the proverbial creek without the proverbial paddle. I don't have an answer to this, and I suspect anybody that says they've got an answer to this is either a genius or lying, or mad.
And again, I mean, and the one big key thing as well is that in politics, the people do matter almost as much as the policies, if not more, actually. If you look at, say, the French centrists with Macron, how they've been able to reboot themselves. If you look at the Tories with Ruth Davidson, having a good leader does go you a long way. And you look at what's happening with Labour this week, you know, you've had Keir Starmer who's talked about as a possible future leader and just be all over the place on whether there's going to be a second referendum, whether he's going to end freedom of movement, how his policy was different to Theresa May's, with Clive Lewis going to all sorts of weird Twitter spats because of odd things his re-election campaign's pumping out. It really doesn't look like there's any easy answers ahead for Labour.
No.
And on that cheery note, we are going to leave you. This has been It Could Be Said. I've been Will Calling. He has been Dr. Luke Middup. You've been listening. And hello to everybody listening to us on halfguarded.com. Hope you enjoyed the show. Talk to you in a while. Bye.